Hi, everybody. Today's Thursday, March 6th, 2025, and our friend Alex Craner is back with us. Alex, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Nima. Always good to join you, and greetings to your viewers and listeners.
Let's get started with what Marco Rubio said yesterday. We were talking about it for more than for almost 3 years of the conflict in Ukraine. And here is what he said, that maybe some sort of drastic change in the way that the United States sees the conflict in Ukraine. Here is what he said.
Beginning that President Trump views this as a protracted, stalemated conflict, and frankly, it's a proxy war between nuclear powers, the United States helping Ukraine and Russia. And it needs to come to an end. And no one has any idea or any plan to bring it to an end. The plan of the Ukrainians up to now and their allies on Capitol Hill and the people you talk to in other countries is, let's just keep giving them as much as they need for as long as it takes. That's not a strategy.
Yeah. For the first time, they're talking about this is a proxy war. And how do you see, Alex, the way that Donald Trump is trying to deal with Ukraine, while we know that the division between the United States and European countries is getting greater?
The way I can make sense of it, Nima, is if we go back to what we know, what George Soros and other Western officials told us, that this is a conflict between two systems of governance. And, you know, one system of governance is the Western oligarchic system that gives rise almost predictably to colonialism, to imperialism, and to fascism. And I think that your choice is not to what extent you will, you know, if you're serious about this, it's not a choice of saying to what extent you might opportunistically support all this because there might be some kind of a profit for you at the end of the road. I think that the real choice, the serious choice, is whether you're going to go along with it or whether you're going to oppose it. And it seems to me, from everything that we've seen so far, that Donald Trump and his government have decided to oppose this system. And so if you oppose this system, then you're opposing the current governments in London, Paris, Berlin, Stockholm, and many others. Some are covertly opposed to it, I suspect. You know, if I were sitting in London in the ruling establishment, I wouldn't quite trust Giorgia Meloni. And then there are others who I would be, you know, wondering about. But I think it's the question of opposing or supporting this system. This system has really given us a lot of these really bad things that we've experienced over the years: creeping totalitarianism, repression, censorship, lies and distortion as the main currency of persuasion, large-scale demoralization of our societies, a collapse of living standards, loss of prosperity. I think even covert opium wars, we see more and more people in the West being addicted to wars, to drugs and alcohol. And then the forever wars. And, okay, I have to say this, I've never seen a public official in any capacity give an interview with a cross on their forehead. But I suspect that there's symbolism in that too. It appears to me that Trump administration is dead serious about what they're doing. And if they're opposed to the oligarchic system of governance that draws its root from the old continent, from Europe, and I think still is headquartered in the city of London, in the, you know, in the strategic, philosophical, spiritual sense, then for Donald Trump and his government, the natural ally is Russia, a Christian nation. And then we also have to ask ourselves about the role of democracy, because what I see by even very learned, very well-intentioned observers and analysts is that they look at Trump and they say, like, oh, Trump is kind of turning totalitarian. Is this a dictatorship being implemented, brought to the United States, ambushing the whole democratic process? And I think that there is something to this. I haven't seen these statements directly, but somebody told me that Peter Thiel was talking about this, that what actually the United States needs is a king, literally. And then people are reticent. They think, like, oh, you know, this is very bad. And I don't know why this is very bad. You know, we have this, it seems to me that we have this kind of a sentimental attachment to the concept of democracy, because that's how we've been reared and educated all our lives, to cherish the rule of the people, for the people and by the people. Except that I think that all these well-intentioned observers should look not at what they think things should be, or what they tell us that they should be, but rather than what the system actually delivers. And we have seen the track record of these quote-unquote democracies, and they have given us all of these things that we have today: permanent wars, totalitarianism, repression, censorship, demoralization of people, collapse of the standard of living, militarization, this almost knee-jerk inclination to go to war whenever, you know, foreign policy is not going to plan. And we see this happening always stemming from these liberal democracies like the UK, France, Spain, Germany, Scandinavian countries, Baltic countries, all of these new copy-paste democracies from the East. They gave us NATO, they gave us warfare. Now we have strong push for rearmament, militarization, reduction of social welfare states in favor of building weapons of war. And so I think that the sentimental attachment to the concept of democracy is misplaced. And I also believe that if we study history carefully, we see that this same conflict between democracies and autocracies draws back all the way to the Greek antiquity. And we always see that it's the oligarchs, you know, the ultimate stakeholders and beneficiaries of this oligarchic system of governance, who are the most vocal defenders of democracy. Isn't that strange? I mean, isn't it strange that billionaires and oligarchs like George Soros and his son Alex Soros are bleeding heart defenders of democracies, as though they really believe that the power should rightfully reside with the ordinary people, that, you know, George Soros and company want us to have power, not them? That's obviously another deception. So I think we've come to the juncture where we have to rethink our concepts, that we have to study what systems actually deliver, not how they advertise themselves. And I think that we have to also shed this illusion, this is also a factoid which has been with which we have been brainwashed, that dictators and autocrats don't respond to the people. They do, actually, and they are always very, very sensitive to the will of the people. And we see that, you know, for example, Vladimir Putin, every time he implements some kind of a very unpopular policy, as he did by not intervening in Ukraine in 2014, extending the age at which people can go into retirement, his approval rating goes way down, and he is not safe in his position by any means. So even dictators, kings, autocrats of other kinds, they're always very, very sensitive to the will of the people. The will of the people ultimately decides how things go. So we shouldn't be afraid of maybe an enlightened dictatorship. And I'm not, you know, I'm not speaking in favor of Donald Trump being a dictator. I'm speaking in favor of us reassessing what we think we know about systems of governance, and then questioning how well the liberal democracies we have today have served us so far. And I think it's quite obvious that they haven't.
Yeah. Alex, when it comes to the way that Donald Trump is dealing with Zelensky, when you just revise what has happened during the meeting between Donald Trump and Zelensky, Donald Trump knows that Zelensky doesn't want peace and peace talks in case of Ukraine the way that Donald Trump wants it. And on the other hand, they bring him and in front of the press, they're discussing, they're just trashing each other, and then they're kicking him out of the White House and sending him back to Ukraine. Putting that in what has happened recently, and the 2 days ago, the yesterday and the day before, we've learned that the United States has cut off the intelligence and military aid to Ukraine. And today we've learned they're talking with the Zelensky's opposition. Poroshenko, Timoshenko, I don't know who's going to be the opposition, who's going to have this, some sort of popularity in Ukraine that can bring some sort of change to Ukraine. But it seems that they have been prepared for this. They knew what they're doing. It wasn't just out of the blue. They just started talking that way to Zelensky in front of the press. It was a sudden moment, an unprepared moment that they have been doing this. How do you see the way that the things are changing in the last few days? And Donald Trump, right now Zelensky, and the division between Trump and the European countries?
Excellent question, Nima. I think this strikes exactly to the core of what's going on. And I'll say what I think, what I gather from the situation, and then I'll try to explain it. I think that the proxy war against Russia via Ukraine has been inverted into a proxy war against the West, particularly the city of London, via Ukraine. And now the belligerents, quote unquote, it's not just Russia, but Russia and the United States. And here's why I think that. You know, this saga now has been brewing for several weeks, actually, since even before September. And what we see in the press from day to day is this talk about a deal, about the rare earth minerals in Ukraine that the United States wants to appropriate, and about security guarantees. So the way British officials and British press are trying to represent it is that, you know, Donald Trump, because he can, decided to be very greedy and to take advantage of poor Ukraine in its hour of need, and to basically blackmail them by saying, okay, you turn over your resource wealth to us, otherwise, no, you know, we're not going to help you at all. And this is again a distortion. So the offer of the rare earth minerals concessions originates at least since September last year, when Volodymyr Zelensky went to New York. He met with Donald Trump at the Trump Towers and offered him the rare earth minerals deal. And the figure of $500 billion comes from Zelensky, not from Trump. Trump didn't invent that figure. Now, then Trump comes into power, and in the next few days, Secretary of the Treasury, Scott Bessent, goes to Kiev with a draft agreement, and Zelensky rejects it. And I thought that was very, very strange. And then he speaks with the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, and he says, yeah, we'll sign that agreement, but I have to run it through my legislative process. And then Marco Rubio gave an interview about this, and he spoke about it, and he said, Zelensky said he would accept the agreement, that he needs to run it through his legislative process. And then 2 days later, he goes to the media and says, I rejected the American deal. And so he now embarrassed the American Secretary of State. He insulted Donald Trump in the process. And I thought that's extraordinarily strange, because how could Volodymyr Zelensky, who is desperate to keep the American support, reject the agreement that he himself offered initially, and to do it in such a brazen, abrasive manner? What could possibly explain this? That didn't seem to make any sense at all. And then, I learned that, there was on the 4 days before Donald Trump was inaugurated, on the 16th January, Sir Keir Starmer, Prime Minister of Great Britain, traveled to Kiev, where he and Volodymyr Zelensky signed a 100-year partnership between the Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland and Ukraine, which apparently contains a secret appendix. And in that secret appendix, it says that upon cessation of hostility, Great Britain will, Ukraine turns over their natural resource wealth, as well as infrastructure, things like ports, natural gas deposits, storage facilities, pipelines, power plants, titanium deposits, and on and on and on, to British interests. So this now explains why Volodymyr Zelensky can't sign the deal with the Americans, because he already signed over the lion's share of Ukraine's wealth to the Brits. And so now the reason why I suspect that the Trump administration is perfectly aware of all this is because Secretary of State Rubio gave after speaking with Zelensky, and after Zelensky rejected the deal, he used the word hustle. He actually said something, I hope that they're not hustling us, but then they know that they are. And they also understand that it's not Zelensky. Zelensky wouldn't dare in a million years do this unless somebody put him up to it. And that somebody is the British ruling establishment. Keir Starmer is just a figurehead. Boris Johnson, again, is very deeply involved. And, two big problems emerged. One is the problem of Zelensky rejecting the American deal. And two is the problem of Zelensky's legitimacy, because his presidential mandate expired in May of last year.
May.
Right? So again, London dispatches Boris Johnson to Kiev, and Johnson arrives there for the occasion of the third anniversary of the special military operation. And that was on 24th February. Two things happened almost immediately. One, Zelensky reversed himself. He said, "No, okay, I'll accept the American deal now." And the second thing that happened is that the Ukrainian Parliament, the Verkhovna Rada, voted to extend Zelensky's presidential mandate. That was the second time they voted, because the first time they voted wrong. But now, Boris Johnson comes there and they vote again. And then they say Zelensky is still president. It doesn't change anything because his term expired. The parliament's vote is a fig leaf because, Ukraine has a constitution, and it's very clear that presidential elections can be delayed and the term is 5 years and not a day longer. So ultimately, what happens is that if the government in Ukraine changes and the next government is aligned with Moscow and or with the new administration in the United States, they will tear up the 100-year partnership agreement between Ukraine and Britain. And so now there's this frantic footwork to keep the United States hooked to the deal, to keep, you know, baiting them to stay on board because, hey, there's this rare earth deal that, you know, you're going to sign eventually. And also to make sure that the United States continues to provide security guarantees for Ukraine. And then, you know, when Boris Johnson was in Kiev and did all that busy work, he also gave a bunch of interviews to the British media. And he kind of gave away the game because he said the agreement is essential to keep the United States committed to support Ukraine militarily and financially. And so now here you have, you know, the strategy is quite transparent. The British and maybe the French as well are inclined to send their troops to Ukraine. If the United States gives them a security guarantee, that means that they will intervene if something happens to them. So let's say if the Russians attack French or British troops, quote unquote peacekeepers, then the United States gets involved to protect them and to maybe retaliate against Russia, against the Donbas. And then also you make sure that the government in Kiev doesn't align with Russia and that it doesn't tear up these agreements that the British have. And okay, so if you had Kamala Harris in the White House and the whole Barack Obama team of public officials, then this would all stick. This would all go. But I think that Donald Trump, of all people, can see a hustle from a light year away, and they recognize what the British are doing. And so I think that Trump is kind of playing along to see where it goes, but he's also trolling them. Like, for example, on the 17th of February, he says that Volodymyr Zelensky is a dictator. Well, you know, if he's a dictator, then his signature on that agreement is null and void. He doesn't represent Ukraine. And so the British officialdom and media just went hysterical and went to Zelensky's defense. And then when Zelensky went to Washington, they understood that there wouldn't be the signing of the agreement that the United States wants. Zelensky wanted security guarantees, and he wasn't going to sign anything anyway. And then what does he do? He flies straight back to London, where he gets hugged and, you know, is lionized as a hero. Keir Starmer equates him with Winston Churchill. The media is lionizing him as a righteous freedom fighter, and on and on and on. But I think that if I'm right about all this, and if I'm right that the Trump administration is perfectly aware of what the game is, then for sure in the background, they are preparing for Zelensky's ouster and for a new acting government, new, you know, and then ultimately new elections. And I believe that they are talking to the Russians about it, and that they know more or less who the candidates would be. And I think that they already most likely know who the next president will be. And I suspect it's going to be Valery Zaluzhny, who is now currently the Ukraine's ambassador in London. So I think that for London and for Western Europe, the game is lost. And they're making a whole lot of noise and doing a lot of trash talk to try to impress everybody that they're serious, that they matter, that they have power, that they can change things. But I think ultimately that they can't.
To understand that, Alex, when we look at the behavior of European countries, you see that they're committing suicide with their attitude in Ukraine. On the other hand, It reminds me, it seems to me that the conflict in Ukraine is turning to be that the new Russia gate for Donald Trump, Russia gate 2.0. In the first one, we had the Democrats in the front line and Europeans backing them. Right now, Europeans are in the front line and Democrats are backing them. The establishment in the United States is behind the scene backing them. I think that Donald Trump would face huge challenges in Ukraine. It doesn't seem the way that, I don't know if you watched Macron talking about his video message about Ukraine and the conflict in Ukraine, and the way that he was picturing Russia, the ultimate enemy of us. They're going to attack us. They're preparing by 2030. They're going to have a lot of weapons, a lot of forces, new forces. They're going to attack us. They're preparing for that. This is not real. This is all fake. They're preparing to attack. They're preparing a new Russia gate, in my opinion. The main goal is Donald Trump. The main objective is Donald Trump. They know what's going on with Ukraine, but they want something else. How do you find it?
You're absolutely correct. And I think that Trump is at risk of sabotage, of new public attacks, and possibly some way of removing him or even assassinating him. The British government, the British Empire, has a long history of assassinating leaders who oppose it. You know, going back to at least Abraham Lincoln. Russiagate, I'm not sure if that's going to fly. We've seen over the last few days 17 Democratic congressmen and women deliver a very strong message against Trump. But they got caught speaking the same message word for word. And then all this erupted on X, where they showed them delivering the same message word for word. People are not stupid. They can see if all these supposed leaders elected by the people are speaking the same message word for word, well, then somebody gave them the message. And that somebody has enough power to tell them, look into the camera and say these words exactly. And then they say, yes, sir. They obey. So there's some kind of a higher power above all these congressmen. We don't know exactly who it is, but we can make an educated guess. And so the 4 years of Russiagate, the 8 years of almost nonstop persecution of Donald Trump with lawfare, they haven't stopped him, they haven't defeated him. And I think that in the process, the American people have learned some important lessons. And we've seen that even some leading Democratic politicians switched sides over to Donald Trump because, you know, the false dichotomy between left and right, people are understanding that that's fake. The real dichotomy is the two systems of governance. And then either you support the globalist oligarchy, the moneylender cabal, or you support people who are fighting for your country's sovereignty and independence. And I think that those fault lines are now clear enough to a critical mass of people that I think that Donald Trump will enjoy sufficient support that he will be, let's say, a lot more insulated from this attack than he was during his first 4 years in office. Now, I see that a lot of analysts, a lot of observers are now coming up and saying, oh, you know, Donald Trump is mounting a dictatorship. Oh, his public support is really not what it's made out to be. Actually, people are against him. It doesn't ring true to me. You know, people cite polls. Polls are rigged by habit. They're routinely rigged. They don't mean anything. I think that the way people are reacting, what you see on social media suggests that actually Donald Trump has very strong support. And then we have the question of Europe, which seems to have united behind warmongers and seems determined to go to war against Russia. But I think that that's very, very hollow, in fact, because it's limited to the ruling establishments who don't actually enjoy support from the people. And then as a result, you know, they have to increasingly engage in censorship. They have to cancel elections. They have to sabotage elections in different ways, as Macron has done in France. They have to rig them, as I think they might have done in Germany. But, you know, if you don't have the support of the people, if the people believe that you're deceiving them and lying, then your whole agenda isn't going to get very far. And then there's a question of money. You know, Ursula von der Leyen wants to spend 800 billion euros on a rearm Europe program. Well, where's she going to get that? You know, where's she going to get 800 billion euros? I think that the only place they can get it from is the printing press, which means that they're going to destroy the euro. And then if your euro is worthless, then your whole house of cards comes down.
Alex, here is what Donald Trump said in his address to the Congress respecting the policy of European countries. Here is what I said.
Europe has sadly spent more money buying Russian oil and gas than they have spent on defending Ukraine, by far. Think of that. They've spent more buying Russian oil and gas than they have defending. And we've...
Yeah. The point that he's raising is so important, Alex. When you hear the German government today said that Germany doesn't plan to reestablish natural gas supplies from Russia or restore the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, here comes the question, who is getting played here? Are they playing themselves? Are they playing their government, the people? Are they harming themselves? For what reason? What is the main objective? What are they doing if Donald Trump is declaring, is saying that they have been spending more money buying Russian gas and oil during this conflict than they have provided Ukraine with money? This is unbelievable. And how corrupt are they? Who's running the show, for example, in Germany?
Oh, I think that the same people are running the show in Germany as are running the show in Paris and in London. We saw when Volodymyr Zelensky was thrown out of the White House, that Ursula von der Leyen and a number of other European officials, I forget the name is exactly, but it's, you know, it's on Twitter, it's on X. They issued the exact same statement word for word of support to Volodymyr Zelensky, you know, stand tall, be brave, be, you know, blah, blah, blah. Exact same message, all four of them. And when you asked who are they playing, I think that they're still playing the United States. And, you know, Keir Starmer says this because when Donald Trump kind of trolled him at the White House, could you take Russia on by yourselves? And then everyone in the room laughed because everybody understands that Britain cannot dream about confronting Russia militarily and prevailing. And then, you know, Europe, if you shake down all of the European NATO powers, it's very doubtful that you can put together 50,000 troops to place in Ukraine. But what Starmer says in his statements, I think he said this in his statement to the parliament the other day, is he said, we're doubling down, we're increasing our commitments to military spending and blah, blah, blah. to show the Americans that we are serious. So it seems to me that the whole agenda is to make a show of determination in order to impress the Trump administration, to say, wow, you know, these people are really determined and they're putting real resources behind, you know, they're putting their wallets where their mouth is. And so, yeah, you know, let's close ranks with them. Let's support them. Let's back them up. And then, you know, the 800 billion euros that Ursula von der Leyen is now talking about, that's another piece of bait for the American military industrial complex, because probably a lot of that money is going to be waved at them to say, hey, you know, we're going to be building a lot of weapons here. How about you come here for some action? And then, you know, the American military industrial complex is going to pressure Trump to join ranks with the Europeans. And then this is, I think, why, as all this is going on, there's a quiet purge going on at the Pentagon. And this is why Donald Trump and his governments are making sure that the people running the US military are loyal to the administration and not to the to the globalist oligarchy.
Yeah. Alex, there are a lot of talks about the tariffs of Donald Trump, Trump's tariff on Mexico, Canada, and China. And we have seen the reactions coming from these countries. But yesterday, we've seen a post from the Chinese embassy in the United States. Here is what they put out. And if war is what the United States wants, be it a tariff war, a trade war, or any other type of war, we're ready to fight it till the end. How do they feel? What do we know about the Chinese and the way that they're seeing the changes that are happening, considering Donald Trump and his administration?
Well, I'm not sure what to think of that. You know, the question of tariffs could turn out to be very complicated. And, you know, Donald Trump makes some of these statements, or other people in his administration, as pretexts to introduce tariffs against this or that country. But I'm not sure whether this is a real thing or if it's a negotiating ploy, because if you introduce tariffs against a country, you have to kind of prepare the ground for it, because in and of themselves, tariffs can exacerbate inflation, which is already potentially a huge problem for Trump administration. And so whether this is just posturing or whether these are real intentions, I think we'll find out with time. But just introducing tariffs like this without preparing the grounds could be very, very counterproductive. And I think it could actually be Donald Trump's Achilles heel, because if the economy goes south, if the U.S. economy goes south, then he opens himself to attacks from his political opponents that are actually going to be gathering some public support. And then he's in trouble. There are measures that the Trump administration can take beyond just introducing tariffs, or he can take them in concert with the tariffs, that could maybe create a buffer, create some financial cushioning. But I think that's going to take a lot of coordination. You know, I think that all the talk about bringing Canada into the United States, bringing Greenland into the United States, I think they're dead serious about this. You know, if we take a step back, the key problem, the problem ultimately, is the overhang of unpayable debts in the United States economy, and you don't have too many ways around that. One of them is default, to say, we can't pay this debt, so we're not going to pay them, too bad. Which would be very bad. Then a different way of default is through inflation, that you simply dilute those debts away. But you can also go the route of increasing the economy's, increasing the wealth and productivity in the economy. And so bringing in Canada and Greenland could be part of that strategy. So if you avail yourself of the economic, you know, like if the economy of Canada suddenly came under the American economy, that would be effectively bringing in wealth from there into your economy, and let's say refloating it. Same with Greenland. There's going to be resources there that the American companies can exploit, that the American banks can fund, and that effectively constitutes new collateral that can back another major credit cycle and improve, you know, let's say reduce the drag from the debt overhang. But that's a whole lot of moving parts that you can manipulate to, let's say, soften the blow from inflation and all this debt, or to, you know, to reduce the impact. And what exactly the administration is going to do about all this is not clear to me. And I think it's not clear because they can't say it, obviously, because they are going to get attacked by their opponents. So I think that some of it is going to be by stealth. And then the real moves, the big moves that they're going to make, I think that they're going to be ambushing us all collectively.
Alex, we know that there is an integrated system of producing cars between the United States, Canada, and Mexico. Some parts of the cars are produced in the United States, in Canada, in Mexico. Then they gather all the parts and assemble the car. How, if Donald Trump goes to the direction of bringing all of these companies into the United States, they would empty Mexico and Canada of the industry. Of this would hugely influence their economy. That's why we're seeing some sort of repercussions in terms of tariffs and the way that Donald Trump is trying to treat them, even with China. Don't you think that this would be a huge sort of challenge for Donald Trump? Because I don't see that he's getting stronger by these new tariffs and the way that he's treating Canada and Mexico. And is that going to benefit? I'm not talking, we know that the main objective of Donald Trump's policies is MAGA and the people who voted for him. But is that going to change his position? Is that going to improve his position? He tried in his address to the Congress, he tried to show that we are getting more powerful, we're getting stronger, we are getting better. But there has to be an outcome for these sort of talks. Without delivering that outcome to the people, how he's going to be able to convince them?
I'm not sure. I think that, you know, talking about bringing car production in the United States has the obvious benefit of creating jobs for the American people, and then you have their political support. Is this going to make a huge difference long term? I'm not sure, and I think it could blow back in some ways as well. I think that in part it's to do with boosting your negotiating position versus your neighbors. I suspect that in part, with respect to Canada, for example, I think that they are actively engineering, well, for the lack of a better term, annexation of Canada. And, you know, the CIA playbook in changing governments usually includes destroying their economies first. You know, because when the economy, you know, as Nixon said, when they wanted to regime change Salvador Allende in Chile, he said, make the economy scream. Because when the economy goes south, then people are very unhappy, and then they want a change in government. And then you offer them a solution and you support people who will say, hey, you know, this is not working out. We should be joining the United States. So that could be a part of it. And then also, you know, Canada is part of the British Commonwealth. And it seems to me that Canada has been quite active in flooding the United States with fentanyl. It's not just Mexico. And I think that the Americans are aware of that. And so I think that putting pressure on Canada serves a, you know, damaging their economy so that one day they might feel inclined to join the United States, and B, weakening the hand of London. So it's very, very, I think it's very, very difficult to judge all these moves without considering what the whole context might be.
Yesterday I talked with Paul Carrick Roberts, and we were talking about the tariffs, and what he mentioned, what was his idea about the Trump's policy, was that they can put tariffs. They know that tariffs would increase the price of the products in the United States, but after all, they can reduce the income tax, because the United States didn't have any sort of income tax before 1913. And they have this sort of experience. That's why maybe Donald Trump is planning for that. Do you think that he's going to do that?
I think it's entirely possible. I think that would be radical and revolutionary, but I think it's possible from what I read. I happen to live in a place where there's no income tax, and the place functions perfectly well. Income tax didn't used to exist in the United States before the advent of Federal Reserve. The government should be able to finance itself without income tax. And income tax is legally and morally wrong. It shouldn't be applied. We only just got kind of used to it. It became a normal. It started with a little bit, but then a little bit more. And then like, oh, look, we have a war. We have to support the war effort. Well, it's going to be a little bit more. And it never goes back. Same in Britain. I think in Britain, they introduced the income tax at some point in 1700s. As a temporary measure to finance some war emergency, and then it never went back again. And I'm not sure that this is going to be possible in the short term, but I wouldn't be surprised that they aren't preparing the terrain for that exactly. It would be absolutely revolutionary, but I think that it could really make America great again, because suddenly, you know, as I mentioned, I live in Monaco. We have no income tax here. So what happens is that the majority of the population of Monaco, maybe 80%, are people who have been successful elsewhere and who earn enough money that by moving to Monaco, they actually save on their tax bills. And so you can imagine that if United States had eliminated income taxes, that the best segment of innovators, inventors, entrepreneurs from everywhere around the world might in the long term gravitate towards the United States and pursue the American dream, but for real, not a fake one. Who knows? I don't know. I think that this is entirely possible, and I I really hope that they are working on that. I think that that would also probably influence many, many other jurisdictions to follow suit. Because if that became successful, if that program became successful, I think it would be very, very difficult for other nations to ignore it.
Alex, just getting back to the deal that you've mentioned about between the United States and Ukraine, the mineral deal and rare earth deal. We know that it's unbelievable that Donald Trump believes that they're going to give him the mineral deal between the United States and Ukraine would give him a very substantial upper hand in terms of competing with China. They're looking after a bigger deal with Russia. And that's, it's, Zelensky was talking about 500 million, I don't know, billion?
Billion. Yeah.
And, but it seems that the contract between the United States and Russia would be much more than that. And how do you see the way that Donald Trump sees the long-term strategy of the United States in terms of making new relationships, new areas of security architecture for the Western Hemisphere, for the Western countries and Russia together?
I think that Trump's choice, if we just looked at the cost-benefit analysis, is very, very obvious, and that choice favors Russia. Okay, let's just start with the mineral wealth, the resource wealth. Ukraine has an estimated $12 to $14 trillion of natural resource wealth. Russia has an estimated $75 to $90 trillion in natural resource wealth. The second problem is the downside risk. So if, let's say, Trump agreed with Keir Starmer, they're like, okay, we're going to back you and you're going to give us, that is, you know, Ukraine, Zelensky is going to sign over some mineral earth to us. Well, for that, the United States have to give a security guarantee to Ukraine, which means that potentially, that will be very, and then as Boris Johnson said, financial support. So you have to provide financial support to Ukraine and take the risk of war against Russia, because, you know, providing security guarantee means that you're going to go to war if Russia violates the territory that you're guaranteeing. And so the downside is potential nuclear showdown with Russia. And the upside is rare earth minerals that are going to, the deal that is going to be implemented through some fund that's going to be created. And then, you know, the United States first has to provide the seed capital for this fund, and then they will get a portion of future proceeds. But they're not going to have necessarily full control over it. And then who knows what might be in it, because some experts that I read say that there are no rare earth minerals in any feasibly exploitable quantities in whatever is under Ukraine's control, and that whatever is there is already under Russian control. So the Russian deal, A, much, much bigger upside. B, there's, the Russians are providing security for free. You don't need to risk U.S. troops. You don't need to risk U.S. Military. You don't have to take the risk of World War III against Russia. So there's very little downside in doing a deal with Russia, and there's a much greater upside. Doing the deal with Ukraine under the leadership of the City of London has huge downside and very dubious upside. So that's that. And then, you know, if the United States gets along with Russia, then it's not just the wealth that's there available in Ukraine, it's the whole $75 trillion worth of Russian resources that are available for joint ventures, mutual cooperation and development, And so I think it's pretty much a no-brainer, unless you're completely obsessed with controlling that and dismembering Russia and regime changing Putin.
I think Alex, what's missing in the mindset of the establishment in the United States is how important Russia is in terms of keeping the balance between the East and the West. I personally don't like a world in which China rules. That would be the same sort of problematic situation that we've been witnessing with the United States being the sole superpower. We need some sort of balance between the East and the West, but they don't appreciate what Russia is and the role that they can play in that sort of strategy. Is there any sort of understanding among the European leaders, which are important when it comes to that sort of strategy?
No, I don't think there's any such understanding among the European leaders, which is why it's only a matter of time until they all get swept out of power. I think that, the disadvantage that we have in the West, and that includes the United States, is that we have been at the receiving end of practically daily 24/7 campaign of demonization of Russia. And the understanding of what Russia is very, very distorted. We all think of it as some dark, rusty place where people have a miserable existence under some harsh, repressive dictatorship, but that's not the case at all. I think that people should consider visiting Russia, traveling there. If they can't, they should follow the account of Westerners who live in Russia, and they will realize that Russia is a normal place. It's not a upper volta with missiles. It's an advanced modern technological society. It's an increasingly prosperous society. And, you know, if you look at the polls, which ask the Russians, are you happy? Are you unhappy? Do you feel free to pursue your life the way you want? Do you approve of your government's leadership? Do you think that the government is moving the country is developing in the right direction? You will see that Russians overwhelmingly answer positively. And, you know, many people in the West will then say, like, oh yeah, but you know, like in a dictatorship, if you criticize, then they come for you and they put you in prison. So people are afraid to say what they really mean. No, that's nonsense. Boris Yeltsin had an approval rating of, depending on who you ask, between 2 and 6%. In the 1990s, and his government was much, much more repressive than the government of Vladimir Putin is. We only liked him because he allowed Western financial institutions and Western corporations to do in Russia exactly whatever they wanted. So that's why we loved him. But the fact that his government was repressive, the fact that he had a very strict control over the media space, much more so than Vladimir Putin, that didn't bother us in the slightest. So, you know, I think we have to overcome this fear of Russia, because it's largely been contrived by propaganda and by distortions, which absolutely do not correspond with the reality.
Thank you so much, Alex. I think we can wrap it up.
Always a pleasure, Nima.
Pleasure. Always a pleasure to talk with you, Alex.
Take care. See you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.